Fightful.com.
King Alfred the Great and our Common Law Code, Part 2. Here are some excerpts from the Code of Alfred. Compare these to a quote from Exodus chapter 20, 3-17. The Lord spoke these words to Moses and said, I am the Lord your God. I led you out of the lands and out of the bondage of the Egyptians. Do not love other strange gods before me. Do not call out my name in idleness, for you are not guiltless with me if you call out my name in idleness. Mind that you hallow the rest day. You must work 6 days, but on the seventh you must rest. For in 6 days Christ made heavens and earth, the seas, and all the shapen things in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord hallowed it. Honour your father and your mother, whom the Lord gave you, so that you may live longer on the earth. Do not slay. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not witness falsely. Do not unrighteously desire your neighbor's goods. Do not make gold or silver gods for yourself. These are the judgments which you must appoint. If anyone buys a Christian slave, let him be bonded for 6 years, but the seventh he must freely be unbought. With such clothes as he went in, with such must he go forth. If he himself had a wife, she must go out with him. However, if his overlord gave him a wife, she and her bairn must go to the overlord. If, however, the bondsman then says, I do not wish to go away from my overlord, nor from my wife, nor from my bairn, nor from my goods. Let his overlord then bring him to the door of the church, and drill his ear through with an awl, as a sign that he should be a bondsman ever since. Though anyone sells his daughter as a maidservant, let her not at all be a bondswoman like other women, nor may he sell her to foreigners. But if he who bought her does not respect her, let her go free, even among foreigners. If, then, he, her overlord, allows his son to cohabit with her, let him give her marriage gifts, and see to it that she receives clothes, and the dowry which is the value of her maidenhood. Let him give her that. If he do none of these things to her, then she is free. The man who intentionally slays another man, let him suffer death. He, however, who slay him out of necessity, or unwillingly, or involuntarily, as when God may have sent him into his power, and when he had not lain in wait for him, he is worthy of his living and lawful fine, if he, the involuntary manslaughterer, seeks asylum. But if anyone presumptuously and willfully slays his neighbour through guile, drag him from my altar, so that he should suffer death. He who smites his father or his mother shall suffer death. He who steals a free man and sells him, and it be proved against him, so that he cannot clear himself, let him suffer death. If anyone smites his neighbour with a stone or with his fist, if he, the one smitten, may go forth, even though only with the help of a staff, get him medicine, and do his work for him, while he himself cannot. He who smites his own bondservant, or bondswoman, if he or she does not die the same day, but still lives for 2 or 3 nights, he is not at all so guilty of death, for it was his own chattel. However, if he or she die the same day, put the guilt upon him, the overlord. If anyone, while fighting, hurt a pregnant woman, let him pay a fine for the hurt, as the evaluators determine. If she die, let him pay soul with soul. If anyone puts out another's eye, let him give his own for it, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. If anyone smite out the eye of his manservant, or his maid servant, so that he makes them one-eyed, for that he must free them. If an ox gores a man or a woman, so that they die, let the ox be stoned to death, but do not let its flesh be eaten. The owner is guiltless. If the ox gored 2 or 3 days earlier, and the owner did not know about it, however, if he did know about it, and if he did not want to impound it, and if it then slay either a man or a woman, let it be destroyed with stones, and let the owner of the slain or the gored bondsman be paid whatever the council finds to be right. If it gore a son or a daughter, it is worthy of the same judgment. However, if it gored a bondsman or bondsmen, let 30 shillings of silver be given to the overlord, and let the ox be destroyed with stones. If anyone digs a water pit, or unties a tied-up animal, and does not tie it up again, let him pay for whatever falls therein, and let him have the dead one. If an ox wounds another man's ox so that it dies, let them sell the live ox and share its value, and similarly also the meat of the dead one. However, if the owner knew that the ox was goring, but did not wish to restrain it, let him give another ox for it, and keep all the meat for himself. If anyone steals another's ox, and slays or sells it, let him give 2 for it, and 4 sheep for 1. If he does not have anything to give, let he himself be sold for the fee. If a thief breaks into a man's house at night, and he be slain there, he, the slayer, is not guilty of manslaughter. If he does this after sunrise, he is guilty of manslaughter, and he himself shall then die, unless he slew out of necessity, if he, the thief, be caught red-handed with what he previously stole, let him pay twofold for it. If anyone harms another man's vineyard, or his acres, or any of his lands, let him pay the fine as men value it. If fire be kindled to burn right, let him who tindered the fire then pay a fine for the mischief. If anyone entrust livestock to his friend, and if he, the friend himself, steals it, let him pay for it twofold. If he does not know who stole it, let him clear himself from the accusation that he committed a fraud. However, if it were quick cattle, and if he says that the army took it, or that it died of itself, and if he has a witness, he need not pay for it. If he, however, has no witness, and if he, the loser of the livestock, does not believe him, let him then swear. If anyone deceives an unwedded woman, and sleeps with her, let him pay for her, and have her afterwards as his wife. However, if the woman's father does not want to let her go, let him, the seducer, give money according to her dowry. Do not let women live who are wont to receive enchanters and conjurers and witches. Let him who has intercourse with cattle suffer death. Also let him who offers sacrifices to the gods, except to God alone, suffer death. You must not vex strangers and those who come from afar, for you were strangers long ago in the land of the Egyptians. Note that not the Unitarian medieval Jews, but the Trinitarian Anglo-Britons are here regarded as the legal continuation of the ancient Israelites. You must not scathe widows and stepchildren, nor harm them anywhere. However, if you do otherwise, they cry out to me, and I hear them, and then I slay you with my sword. Thus I make your wives to be widows, and your bairns to be stepchildren. If you give money as a loan to your comrade who wants to dwell with you, do not pressure him as one in need, and do not oppress him with interest. If a man has nothing but a single garment with which to cover himself or to wear, and he gives it as a pledge, before the sun sets, give it back to him. If you do not do so, he calls out to me, and I hear him, for I am very mild-hearted. You may not revile your lord, nor curse the overlord of the people. Your tithe monies and your first fruits of things that go and things that grow you must give to God. You may not eat at all of that meat which wild animals leave. Give it to the hounds. Do not listen to the words of a liar, nor permit his judgments, nor speak to anyone who gives testimony in his favor. Do not, beyond your right reason, wend yourself to people who are unwise and unrighteous in their wishes when they speak and cry out, nor to the learning of the most unwise. Do not permit them. If another man's stray cattle come into your power, though it be your foe, make it known to him. You must judge very evenly. Do not give one judgment to the wealthy, but another to the poor, nor give one judgment to the more beloved, and another to the more disliked. Always shun lies. You must never slay a righteous and unguilty man. You must never accept bribes, for they all too often blind wise men's thoughts and turn their words aside. Do not act in any way uncouthly towards the stranger from abroad, nor oppress him with any unrighteousness. Never swear by heathen gods, nor may you call out to them in any way. As former Harvard law professor Harold J. Berman has remarked, Alfred's laws are largely a recapitulation of earlier collections made by previous monarchs. Thus, Alfred's laws contain such striking provisions as doom very evenly, do not doom one doom to the rich and another to the poor, nor doom one doom to your friend and another to your foe. These Alfredian provisions do in fact reflect the judicial laws of Moses. For you shall do no injustice in judgment, you shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbour fairly. The stranger, which was the Brittonic Welshman, and even the Anglo-Dane, that dwells with you, i.e. with Alfred's Englishman, shall be to you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself. In all this, Alfred must be regarded as a precursor of the later Westminster Assembly of Britain's Parliaments, which did the same. The well-known professor of English history, Dr. John Richard Green, records that all the English kind turned to Alfred, according to the Saxon Chronicle, save those that were under bondage to Danish men. Professor Green explains that the king turned again to his work of restoration. He found time, amidst the cares of state, for the daily duties of religion, for converse with strangers, for study and translation, for learning poems by heart, for planning buildings and instructing craftsmen in goldwork, for teaching even falconers and dog-keepers their business. Yet his mind was far from being imprisoned within his own island. He listened with keen attention to tales of far-off lands, to the Norwegian Othere's account of his journey around the North Cape to explore the White Sea, and to Wolfhere's cruise along the coasts of Estonia. Envoys bore his presents to the churches of India and Jerusalem. Alfred was preeminently a man of business, careful of detail, laborious and methodical. He carried in his bosom a little handbook in which he jotted down things as they struck him. Now a bit of family genealogy, now a prayer, now a story, such as that of Bishop Eldhelm singing sacred songs on the bridge. Each hour of the king's day had its peculiar task. There was the same order in the division of his revenue and in the arrangement of his court, but active and busy as he was, his temper remained simple and kindly. Tradition told of his genial good nature, of his chattiness over the adventures of his life, and above all of his love for song. In his busiest days, Alfred found time to learn the old songs of his race by heart and bade them be taught in the palace school. He found comfort in the music of the Psalms. What he aimed at was simply the education of his people. Alfred desired that at least every free-born youth who possessed the means should abide at his book till he can well understand English writing. Thus says Professor Green. Alfred himself superintended a school which he had established for the young nobles of his court. He resolved to throw open to his people, in their own tongue, the knowledge which had until then been limited to the clergy. He took his books as he found them. They were the popular manuals of his age, the compilation of Orosius, which was then the one accessible book of universal history, the English history of his own people by Bede, the Consolations of Boethius, and the Pastorals of Gregory. Alfred translated these works into English, but he was far more than just a translator. He was an editor for his people. Here he omitted, and there he expanded, simple as was his aim. Alfred created English literature. The famous modern Welsh historian and writer, G. M. Trevelyan, observes that Alfred the Great is naturally to be compared to Charlemagne, the European continent's Charles the Great. Each had many-sided talents. If Alfred's lot was cast in narrower geographic limits than the Napoleonic arena of Charlemagne's activities, his work has lasted longer. He and his sons made Anglo-Saxon and Celto-Britain in England one forever. The memory of Charlemagne, however, does not suffice to unite Germany and France. After Alfred's defeat of the Danes, who lived in eastern England, and his peace treaty with them, the cessation of the Danish raids, now secured, enabled Alfred to unify his kingdom as never before. The Saxon jurisprudence, with its graded adjudicatures, was now also subjected to the equity of Alfred, who willingly heard the complaints of even the very humblest of his subjects. The judge's knowledge of the law improved, crimes were speedily punished, and theft and murder almost disappeared. Poetry was stimulated, and social welfare work was done by Englishmen in the name of Christ to help the poor, not only in Britain, but also in France, and even as far away as India. Now, at last, Alfred was able to concentrate on the expansion of English culture, inviting to his court the most distinguished scholars from Britain and from abroad. He himself then mastered literature and opened schools throughout his kingdom. He wished the children of every free man to acquire the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. The English clergy were also to be trained thoroughly. That is why, to help promote all of this, Alfred himself translated the Psalms of the Holy Bible and Bede's Church History and Boethius's Consolations of Philosophy and Orosius's Universal History and Gregory's Pastorals and Dialogues and Augustine's Soliloquies into his mother tongue, Anglo-Saxon, He himself also began the inscripturation of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. To get all of this done, he rose early and worked at a variety of different tasks, long and hard, and all to the glory of God. The Elizabethan chronicler and historian Raphael Hollinshead has an extended section on King Alfred. He records that to speak sufficiently of the worthy praise due to so noble a prince as Alfred might require eloquence, learning, and a large volume. Good laws, among the clinking noise of armour, are oftentimes put to silence. Yet he, perceiving how his people were grieved with the thieves and the robbers who grew and increased in those times of war, devised good statutes and wholesome ordinances for the punishment of all such offenders. Among other things, he ordained that the counties should be divided into hundreds and tithings. That is to say, quarters containing a certain number of townships adjoining together. Thus, every Englishman living under prescript of Alfred's laws should have both his own hundred and his own tithing. The tithing was originally a small district where, as in Holy Scripture, one alderman or elderman was in charge of 10 heads of households, and 10 such tithings constituted 100, where 100 man was originally in charge of 10 tithings. The hundred had its own court and was the intermediate unit of government between the village and the shire. Initially, each hundred consisted of 100 hides, a hide being the unit of land needed to support one peasant and his whole family. This biblical system of government is still to be seen even today in the theory of Presbyterian church government with its wards, sessions, presbyteries, and general assemblies. In Alfred's England, if any man were accused of any offence, he would have to find surety for his good demeanour. If he could not find such as would answer for him, then he himself would taste extremity from the laws. If any man that was guilty fled before he found such surety, or after, all the inhabitants of the hundred or the tithing where he dwelt would be put to that fine. By this device, Alfred brought his country into good tranquillity. He caused bracelets of gold to be hanged up aloft on hills where the common highways lay, to see if any dare be so hardy to take them away by stealth. He was a generous prince, especially in all the relief that he gave to the poor. The foundation of the University of Oxford passed all the rest of Alfred's constructions. He began it by the good exhortation and advice of Nicetas, in those days highly esteemed by Alfred for his virtue and learning. King Alfred minded well the commonwealth of his people. In that season, when learning was little esteemed among the Western nations, he studied by all means possible to instruct his subjects in the trade of leading an honest life, and to encourage them generally to embrace learning. He would not permit any to bear office in his court unless they were learned. He was so careful in his office that he divided the 24 hours containing the day and the night into 3 parts. Thus, he spent 8 hours in writing, reading, and making his prayers. Another 8 he employed in relieving his body with meat, drink, and sleep, and the last 8 he bestowed in dispatching business concerning the government of the realm. He had in his chapel a candle of 24 parts, of which every one lasted an hour. The sexton, to whom that charge was committed, by burning this candle, ever warned the king how the time had passed away. He hastened to help all Britons, whether Anglo-Danes, Anglo-Saxon Englishmen, or Celto-Britons. A little before his death, Alfred ordained his last will and testament. He bequeathed half the portion of all his goods, justly gotten, to such monasteries as he had founded. All his rents and revenues he divided into two equal parts. The initial part he divided into three. He bestowed the first upon his household servants, the second to such labourers and workmen as he kept in his works on sundry new buildings, and the third part he gave to strangers. He was very diligent in inquiring how the judges of his land behaved themselves in their judgments, and was a sharp corrector of them which transgressed in that way. To be brief, he so lived that he was regarded in great favour by his neighbours, and highly honoured among the strangers. Thus, says Holinshed, some of the last enacted of all of King Alfred's laws are those found in the International Christian Peace Treaty that he signed with his defeated enemy and convert, Guthrum the Dane. Attenborough explains that in 866 there occurred the great pagan Danish invasion, which eventually put an end to all the existing English kingdoms, except for Wessex, and in other respects exercised a profound influence on the subsequent history of the country. The crisis of the invasion came when the Danish King Guthrum was defeated by King Alfred in 878. In accordance with the surrender terms, the previously pagan, but now converted Guthrum, submitted to be baptized, together with his leading men, and to evacuate Alfred's kingdom. The Danish army then delivered hostages to the King of England, and promised on oath to quit that kingdom. The King of the Danes also agreed to be baptized, and it was done, for Guthrum, the chief of their kings, came to Alfred for baptism, and Alfred became his godfather. Even the great sceptic, Sir David Hume, states that Guthrum was baptized as a Christian and bound by a solemn peace, or frith. The peace had, in fact, saved little more than loose confederacies, but in saving Wessex, it saved the English, or rather the English kind. It also helped to create the nation of England. The longer version of Alfred and Guthrum's peace treaty declares, "This is that peace which King Alfred and King Guthrum and all the Witan of Angle kind, alias the English Parliament, and all the Anglo-Danish people that be in East Anglia have all ordained and fastened with oaths, who of God's mercy reckon for themselves and for their descendants, both for born and unborn. If a man becomes slain, we value all equally dear, English and Danes. If a man accuse the king's thane of manslaying, if he dare clear himself, let him do that with 12 king's thanes. We all ordained on that day that men swore the oaths that neither bond nor free might fare or go into the army without leave, to evidence that men should know that man has a clean back, or has acted honestly." There is further additional legislation which King Alfred, together with King Guthrum, and afterwards also Alfred's son and successor, King Edward, together with King Guthrum, enacted and agreed upon. This was done once the West Saxons and the Anglo-Danes unreservedly entered into relationships of peace and friendship. That legislation was strongly biblical and Christian. It covered the worship of the one true triune God, tithes, sanctuary, clerical transgressions, incest, suicide, Sunday trade, capital punishment, sorcery, and prostitution. The great German historian and writer, Reinhold Pauli, said of Alfred that the qualities of his mind were those of a statesman and a hero. The most unshakable courage was most certainly the first component of his being. He also possessed a decided turn for invention. The pillars on which a Thelney church was built, the long ships he constructed, the manner in which he turned a river from its natural course, and his ingenious clock of tapers with which to measure the passage of time, afford us just as convincing evidence of his powers of thought as do the battles which he gained. Alfred died in 901 AD, precisely a millennium later. In 1901 AD, Lord Rosebery said of him at Winchester, during the celebration of the Alfred millenary, that with his name, England now associates her metropolis, her fleet, her literature, her laws, her first foreign relations, and her first efforts at education. Alfred is, in one sentence, the embodiment of British civilization.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.